Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Show through BBS Radio. It is February the 4th, 2012. I'm coming to you from a smaller Canadian town just outside of Ottawa, Ontario, Canada's capital. And the Zero Point Show, we're approaching our sixth year of the Zero Point Show. And the focus of the show generally has been the study of mystical and spiritual teachings as pertain to the issues of psychology and science. And in the area of psychology, we particularly focus on the issues of human consciousness, which is regarded as the ultimate mystery in psychology and science today. Is one of the most profound mysteries at the heart of being, is what is the nature of human consciousness. And through the most of the past 5 years, I've had as my co-host my friend James Moffitt. And Jim and I, we met back, I think, in high school in grade 12 or earlier. And through our lives, we've shared an interest in the issues of psychology and science. And it's over 30 years ago that we both became interested in the psychology of the Gurdjieff-Uspensky Fourth Way teaching. And over the last 30 years, we've both shared in quite much broader esoteric studies and studies of science and science philosophy and such. So Jim and I have kind of worked, had a collaboration through the past 30 years. And so just recently, Jim's kind of decided to take a bit of a hiatus from the show and continue to be a part of the show, but take on a different role for a while because of other obligations in his life. And I've asked him just to come on as a final time and just, we'll kind of talk about that new role a little bit and do a bit of a review of what we've accomplished over the past 6 years. So I'll bring on my co-host from Toronto, Ontario. Jim, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks, Chris. How are you?
Good. Nice sunny day up here today.
Yeah, it continues to be peculiar Canadian weather for the winter. February in Toronto is usually a little colder and a lot more snow, but
It's been a mild winter. Yeah,
very peculiar. Yeah. I just want to mention that it's going on 35 years now in terms of we're into our 36th year of studying Gurdjieff and Uspensky material, because it was 1976 when I think we both began to study the fourth way.
Oh, yeah. Well, wow.
Years are piling up, yeah. Yeah, and I guess I think it was 1967 we met, so I don't even know what the math is on that, I'm afraid to ask. That's 45 years, I guess, so, you know.
Yeah, I remember you from history class. You were that guy who seemed so bright and knowledgeable in history class. We had Mr. Eady.
Yeah,
Eddie. He was a good teacher. I liked him.
He was a great teacher. Yes. And you were the guy that started your speech in English class. I always remember this. The best first line of any speech I ever heard was, "Hello, have you been bothered by LSD in your sugar cubes lately?"
You're joking.
And it was on that. And your speech was on LSD.
Oh, yeah.
It was about LSD. It wasn't on LSD, but yeah, it was very interesting, actually. I thought, that's very interesting, you know, that, and it's funny, like, coming full circle, because I've just been reading Stanislav Grof's book, The Cosmic Game, recently, and he is one of the few people who's actually done very serious and interesting research on LSD and its relationship to what he calls holotropic states of consciousness, which can be induced by a variety of substances and practices, and he has kept done thousands and thousands and thousands of sessions with people, and has very intriguing descriptions of what people experience, and it's, you know, it's kind of in that during the drug culture years, it was, well, acid is just ineffable, you can never reduce it to any kind of meaningful categories or anything, and the experience itself is sort of beyond the parameters of normal consensual reality, and doesn't easily reduce itself to any kind of description in terms of normal language and common sense usages. But I think it's a big mistake to say that it's indefinable in any ways, because I think there's very striking aspects about the experience that are very valuable, and are particularly valuable from a mystical and esoteric perspective, that there are categories within that framework which I think do apply to some aspects of the LSD experience. It's a shame that LSD became so demonized and associated with just, you know, all these excesses, and because there's very promising research on its use in working with alcoholics and even with autistics, and it's a shame that more research hasn't been done. But I found Groff's work very, very interesting, and that's what I've been reading. One of the books I've been reading.
I think also some of the drug researchers tended to move more towards what they call feeling enhancers.
Yeah.
MDA and MMDA.
Yeah.
Which I can see a bit, because in a way LSD is a bit too, can be quite mentally disruptive.
Well, yeah, just destabilizing and dangerous for people who don't have a firm grasp. I mean, I personally know somebody who had, I think, really terrible experience with LSD and was not a stable personality and was not a person who should have been doing it, you know.
And I've known some similar people, I think, quite damaged by it.
Yeah.
I mean, I
very
think
powerful
it,
drug.
It shocks me that I did that in high school, because I don't think when I was in high school I'd even tried LSD.
No,
you hadn't
tried it.
No, I didn't think so. No.
No,
and it was funny, because I remember it was at university that we began to do it, myself and yourself and some other friends of ours, and I mean, I remember the first time I did it. And I'd gone into psychology. I was interested in the nature of the mind and altered states, and I was interested in psychoses and a kind of human psychopathology. And I remember the first time I did LSD, and it was like I felt a clarity of consciousness and a heightened awareness, which really was quite thrilling. And I remember coming back, like from the trip, and feeling, wow, I learned more in that one session of LSD than I've learned in 3 years of academic studies at the university. Like, it taught me something, and it's hard to define what it is it taught me, but I knew it taught me that our experience of the world is dependent on our own state. Like, normally we just think we are the way we are, Whereas on that, it's like it opens the doors of perception, and I felt more in contact with reality, less so than less out of contact. I mean, I know it depends on what people do under the influence of LSD. I know we used to go and play in Vincent Massey Park, so we were in a natural setting, and there wasn't alcohol involved, and I think we always respected the drug, so didn't just overuse it. In a way, we saw it almost part of our explorations of the psyche and of ourselves. I think I learned a lot from that, and I remember still thinking that, I mean, I remember we came down and it's like, oh, I just wanted to have that experience and be back in that state. But over time, I realized that the way to attain those kinds of states is more through the working on yourself and making efforts to awaken. And that was a path, not relying on drugs, but leads to many similar kinds of experiences. So I think it was a very valuable experience for us both at that period.
Yeah, and I think later when, in terms of the studying Gurdjieff's teaching, and he talks about the process of identification, how we're emotionally invested and identified, attached to everything, and the importance of disidentifying as a prerequisite for developing consciousness. And he says that as long as you're identified, you can never really develop consciousness, because your I is always fused with whatever you're identified with, and to experience real I in yourself requires that you disidentify. And I think one of the things that I had experienced, I think we both had experienced, and we talked about quite a bit, was that you, under the influence of LSD, you disidentify, but you realize kind of the the inherent falsity of much of what you are normally attached to or invested in, as that you did, that there's an expression that you wear your conscience on your sleeve, and when you're on acid, in a sense, it's like you just see the game structure of everything in which people become conditioned and habituated to, not only intellectually but emotionally. And I think that when I began to study the fourth way, I started to have more. That's what I was alluding to earlier, is I said more of a framework in which to understand some of these very strange experiences that I'd had, and these feelings that this was more real. As you say, you realize that your state determines your relationship to the world, and your sense of meaning is very much tied to your state, and you realize that it's quite possible to have these radically different states of consciousness, which lead to radically different frameworks of meaning and ways of seeing things. It's like that famous William James quote where he says that our normal waking state of consciousness is but one state of consciousness, whilst all around it there exist other forms. And he goes on, he says, you can apply the requisite stimulus and in an instant you can experience completely different states and just experience different levels of meaning of the world. And I think that's very true, and I think that's essentially what's missing in almost all contemporary academic considerations of consciousness, is that people, they focus on the normal waking state as they understand it, and which is very limited level of understanding. And sorry, I'm a little cat fight here. Very little, limited level of understanding, and then they pretend that nothing else exists. But there's a huge body of literature from everything from mysticism and esotericism to drug experiences to spontaneous states of higher consciousness, which shows that William James is right. There are all these other states of consciousness that are available to us, and that really our normal waking state is what determines our consensual reality is really quite arbitrary and can be changed very rapidly, and reveals that how arbitrary it really is.
Yeah, I know in the Gurdjieff work, it's there's an emphasis in overcoming patterns of conditioning. And I think LSD, in a way, accomplishes that. It breaks down the usual automated patterns of thinking and feeling and action that characterize people in their life. It's like all that stuff's completely gone, and you kind of come back. I think you're closer to essential consciousness, if it's in the right setting, of course, and set and so on. I think you're closer to your essence. Like the colors are enhanced and your awareness is enhanced, and it's not delusional, even though some people have that kind of experience. But anyway, I didn't want to stay with this. But we've had since those days back in high school, you know, we've explored the Gurdjieff teaching, and then I kind of moved on into the heart doctrine after that, and this kind of alternative model that human consciousness is connected to the heart and blood flow rather than being centered in the mind, in the head. And then we've kind of moved beyond that into studies of the secret doctrine and a wide range of metaphysical studies and the principles of creation. It's been a fascinating 30 years we've had exploring these realms. And I really want to thank you for, you know, through the last years being such a part of that. I think we've created quite a library of kind of documentary material looking at these issues of consciousness and psychology of the soul and creation physics and so on.
Yeah, I feel the same way. It's ironically, part of the reason why at this point I'm taking a little bit of a break from the show is that I'm trying to finish the book I'm writing about your work and our work, and I just really need to. I have a full time job, and actually I have another job as a freelance legal writer, so I don't really have as much time as I'd really like to be able to attend to my own work, and then of course quite a bit of research to be done and reading. So. I mean, this is the participation in the show. It's almost 6 years, as you say, has been very, very good. Because many times, I mean, we've experienced this. I think over the last, many, many years, is that when you have a conversation about so many of the topics that we've discussed with regard to esotericism and mysticism and psychology of consciousness issues in science and religion. It's not until you really, sometimes you say things that you really know what you know. It's in the course of conversation, things often come out or novel ideas emerge or novel interpretations of things emerge that before hadn't really been articulated. So it's been very worthwhile.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure if, I don't know if anybody actually listens to this program with any regularity, but I think you could learn quite a bit about the mystical and esoteric perspective and many of the issues we've talked about. But I think we probably learned more than anybody that has listened. I mean, it's been very, very valuable for me, extremely valuable. And also, too, just at times it's like when you're trying to explain or reduce things to their essential features or attributes, it's a good exercise because it really hones your own thinking.
I find it
much easier to write about these things based on in part on these discussions. So, enormously complex topics we're talking about here. It's not easily grasped or
no, and it's not all at once. It's something you have to consider over time, and as we've tried to explain, you have to study consciousness in yourself, and we've tried to explain methods of trying to do that and basic understanding that's useful to that. So what we're going to do now is, Jim, you're going to come in sometimes, we were talking about sharing some book reviews over the next while, because Jim and I are both avid readers and always,
I was just going to say, I think that's, you had suggested that when we were corresponding about my new role, and I think that's a good idea, is to come in and maybe we can address certain selected topics and focus specifically on perhaps some of the books that we've read or that I've read, and we can discuss those on air I'd like to make that contribution. That'd be great,
And even chapters in the problem of God's contracting universe, if you
want to come in on occasion
and share some of your writings and different chapters of that, you'd be welcome to do that as well.
Yeah, I'd very much like to do that because there's some of those things I think stand quite well on their own as individual topics, and we could examine that certainly in keeping with the perspective of the show and the focus of the show. That's what I'll do.
Okay, so we'll have you back sometime in the future. Keep working at the problem of God's contracting universe.
Yeah.
I'd love to see you find a publisher for that and complete that work.
Yeah, I'm almost there, but it's the last part is there's some sort of proverb about that, about the last 5%. The hardest 50% or something, I don't know. Finishing it off is, as you know, having written many books, it's always sort of the hardest part to get to the finish line. But I'm pretty close, and as I say, that's what I really want to focus my efforts on in the coming months, because I really want to get it. There are other things happening with me professionally that are going to be very demanding on my time, so that's why I'm sort of stepping away at this point. But I'll be back. Thanks very much, Chris. And thanks to BBS and to Doug and Don and to Seth and everybody there. It's been really a privilege to have this forum for the past 6 years and to be able to discuss these things. I feel very fortunate to have been involved in that, very privileged. So thank you. Thank you, BBS.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks, Chris. I'll talk to you later.
Okay. Bye, Jim.
Thank you, Jim.
Bye.
Okay, so I have a guest scheduled for today, so I'm going to move on and introduce our guest, and I hope he'll stay with us for most of the remainder of the show. And my guest is, his name is Christopher Porter, and he is currently the head of the Canadian Action Party. And when I woke up, I had a rude awakening in 2006, kind of waking up to the deception of 9/11, and then subsequently realizing more and more about what's been going on in our society. And in Canada, I came across the Canadian Action Party, and became involved with them in 2008, and I attended their convention, and I became, I submitted two policies which were passed at the convention and are still part of the CAP policies, and I subsequently served as the Native and Aboriginal chair and then helped continue to develop policies with the Canadian Action Party. And we're lucky in Canada that we have a truly alternative party, and although I subsequently stopped working with CAP, because I realized I had to focus on producing my other books on mystical teachings and science and such, I'm again coming back to CAP, and I'm honored today to bring on the new leader of CAP, which is Christopher Porter. Welcome, Christopher.
Thank you for having me, Christopher.
Okay. Do you go by your full name, Christopher?
Yes, I do. I actually ended up spending a few years in Europe where they don't actually like shortening names, and so after some time there, I grew accustomed to coming back to my native name and now continue with it.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. In my life, I went through most of my life just being called Chris, but at a certain point in my life, I felt I had attained my own I, which is a concept from the Gurdjieff teaching, but it is like being individuated. And then I started, I wanted to be called by my full name. It's a nice name. It may sound funny, two Christophers on the line together.
Yeah, it's very rare these days, but yes.
So how long ago, Christopher, you're the temporary leader of CAP. Maybe you could give us a little bit of background and where that stands.
Yes, I'm the interim leader since September of 2000. Whoa, it might be. Oh, it's over a year now, a year and a half and a bit. Now heading up into the party. What's happened to me is I was overseas for much of my life, and in the last 10 years, spent in the South Pacific with villagers there. And while I was there, this was 2001. I originally started there. And then 2002 came along with. In 2003, 2004, and I watched the country change from having very little international focus on it to complete focus on it. And the World Bank moved in, 2,000 troops moved in, there was a securing of their natural resources because the country is very small but has an economic zone of Europe with all the waterways. It's made up of 1,200 islands, Solomon Islands in the South Pacific. And I watched all these organizations come in and slowly start whittling away at their natural resources and trying to get things privatized, privatize their gold, privatize their tuna, talk to the locals about they should join the World Bank and talk about different currencies, talk with some central bank governors that were even introducing some new currencies into the system. And I was shocked to find it out. And before that, I was very non-political. I was busy doing my own things and wasn't very interested in it. But the country was so small, you couldn't ignore what was happening. And while I was there, some people started sending me articles and videos to watch of what was happening with the monetary system and why the World Bank needed to be regulated and why it needed to be stopped. And I came across the Canadian Action Party and thought, wow, here's a party started by an ex-deputy prime minister, and it started because he's fearful that we're losing Canada. And this was all the way back in 1997, and got intrigued in it and started researching it and just was shocked to see how far our country has gone in the opposite direction and how far our reputation's been tarnished, and went from being non-political to now leading the party because I'm just so passionate that we got to protect Canada. It's such a beautiful place and has such a great reputation. We need to retain it.
And it's like we need to retain the sovereignty of countries around the world. Why stamp out their individual nature and kind of local government?
Exactly. It's so important to have individualism, and globalization is just based on a one-mode model, a one currency, a one government, one religion, all aspects of your life. And the beauty of civilization is that we are so diverse, and that's what I learned in the South Pacific. They're only the population is just under a million, and yet they have 1,200 dialects within their region.
Wow.
And they all work through a consensus model, a model of sitting down with each other and trying to find a balance of what's right and what's wrong and making decisions based on the benefit of the entire group. And when we have corporations in Canada trying to dictate and successfully dictating to our government how we manage our resources and what decisions we make and what border agreements we do without the consultation of Canadians, it's wrong. It's inherently wrong. And we need to retain our strength back. I mean, we need to retain the voice of the people and get back that reputation that Canada has of being a peacekeeper and of being a friend to the world.
We see now, too, how so many of these things have been brought in incrementally, and the citizens haven't been really informed about what's being done. It's been a hidden agenda that no one publicly addresses. I think that's
yes,
most disheartening about the whole process. It's like these people had no respect for kind of the democratic vote or principle in Canada. They undermined it subversively. It's really in service of the corporate and banking elite.
And it's based on a tendency of society to go back towards a complete legal justification of every action. And as people that are familiar with law understand, you can justify both sides of any situation. And so we have organizations here that are worried about their self-preservation and worried about the interest of their own dollars and cents and their own ability to control the populace without actually caring if the population supports them. And that's what I always believe. You know, I don't call myself a politician. I call myself a Canadian that's upset with the situation, and that's the political arenas where you can voice it, but we need more participants in the political arena to start saying, look, you're not speaking on my behalf, and that's the role that you are given as an MP. And we have a three-party political system here where the MPs basically follow whatever their party whips are telling them, and that's not on behalf of the people that have elected them, and they're not, definitely not, an MP position is a $148,000 job. Somebody better be held accountable, and party whips shouldn't be the ones to determine how they're held accountable.
Okay, and the Canadian Action Party has a very interesting history. I guess the founder was Paul Hellyer, and he at one point was the defense minister in who was it? Whose government? Trudeau's government.
Trudeau's government. Yeah, and he was deputy prime minister. You know, it's an amazing history for the party.
And he particularly at that time, I think one of his main platforms was that we needed to use the Bank of Canada and take back control over printing our money. I guess in the States, this kind of position is closest to Ron Paul's. And in Canada, we still have our own bank, but apparently we only print like 3-5% of our own monies. Maybe you want to give a little bit of background about CAP's monetary policy.
Yes, certainly. In 1938, the Bank of Canada was nationalized by Prime Minister William Lyon Mackenzie King, and he gave the bank to the Canadian populace and said, you know, this is in your best interest, it's in Canada's best interest, because any nation that controls the creation of its currency controls the direction of its country. And as soon as we get indebted to private banking institutions, the decision makers now become those that are holding our debt. And the Bank of Canada, when it was nationalized, got the Depression, got us through the Second World War, created the huge infrastructure and social projects such as the Trans-Canada Highway, our healthcare system. it did some amazing things.
St. Lawrence Seaway was built with Canadian money, and I think they built a lot of public housing after the war. So Canada's had a history of using our own Bank of Canada to fund these kind of infrastructure projects. Okay, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Chris, but go ahead.
No, that's great. It's good to share all the perspectives, because what you bring up a great point is we were using it. This isn't something brand new. What Paul Hellyer brought up in the Canadian Action Party wasn't something that he just wanted to try. It was based on a system that worked in the past. And when we got up to the 1970s, Canada had a debt around $18 billion. Well, we decided to change the monetary system, or the government decided to change it and move away from money creation being originated for the Bank of Canada, from the Bank of Canada for Canadians, to private banking institutions and global banking organizations. Well, since 1974, our debt has increased 3,000%, so now we are paying over $170 million of interest each and every day. It's shocking stranglehold the world banking organizations have upon Canada now because of these decisions.
I once heard a figure, and I don't know if this is correct, but the figure suggested that 87 cents of every tax dollar went to service the debt. Is that a reasonable figure? Are you familiar with any figure along that line?
Well, definitely there's been a lot of work on proving and showing that huge proportion, and I'm not exactly sure the exact percent, but it is a huge proportion of our tax system is in order to service this debt. And that it's frightening, as anybody who knows going through life and being in debt and having debt collectors come towards you or have an interest in what you're doing because they want their money back. When you are now talking about a Canada as rich, or a country as rich as Canada, with a huge amount of resources such as oil and natural gas and potash and all the natural resources we have, our timber and our lumber, it's shocking to think now we are in such a state of debt where we are contemplating and actually executing privatization plans to take over these resources in order to combat this debt. And it's all geared up. You know, there's enough literature out there, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, on how the World Bank works. I saw it for myself firsthand in the South Pacific, and that's what awoke me. And Canadians need to awaken to say, we are sacrificing our children's future, we're placing them in such debt that we are no longer making the decisions for our behalf, and that's wrong.
And it's really quite tragic, because you look at the world situation and you see all these countries have been impoverished in the same way, with such huge debts. So that the people,
and when Prime Minister Harper talks about, he reminds Canadians we don't have a Canadian economy, we only have a global economy, I ask myself, and this is what helps awaken you, is, I've traveled the world, and I haven't seen any perfect economic model out there. I haven't seen a nation that's looking after. There's definitely some better ones out there, but there isn't the most idealist. And so why are we following the motto of other nations that aren't working? Canada had a system that was working. It was utilizing its central bank. It was a bank for Canadians by Canadians. And we still have the power to use it again. We have to question why we're not using it. And as long as we have bank governors that are ex-Goldman Sachs employees, we have to question truly what is the agenda and where is the direction of this country going. And it's not going in the best interest of all Canadians.
And we see another example of this in the States. I think there's one state that has its own bank. It may be Montana. But whatever state that is, they're the one state that is in financial, like in a good financial position, the one state that runs its own bank. And it's just so natural in a way that the government, you know, by being involved in the banking, kind of returns the profits into the country instead of the wealth being sapped from outside.
Yeah, one of the best analogies for, you know, so sometimes people, the topic of economics gets so complicated, people tend to turn off their thought process during it. But one of the best visuals that or stories that was explained to me was a banker walks into a hotel room and he puts $100 down on the table and says, I'd like to take a look at your rooms and I'll make my decision after. And the banker goes up and gives the $100 onto the desk, and the hotel keeper says, well, he's going to love these rooms, so I'm going to go grab this $100 and I'm going to go pay my butcher because I have a bill to pay. And he goes, pays his butcher, and the butcher says, thanks very much, great, I can go pay my tab at the restaurant. And he goes to the restaurant and he pays his $100 tab at the restaurant, and the restaurant owner says, great, I can pay my beer supplier. And he pays his beer supplier, and the beer supplier, great, I can pay my waitress. And the waitress says, great, I can go back and pay my hotel room for when my grandma stayed here the last week. And the waitress goes back into the hotel and puts the $100 back onto the table. And just as the banker's coming back, checking out the rooms, and the banker comes up and says, you know what, I've decided I'm going to stay somewhere else. And he takes his $100 and he goes away. But in that moment, five people all had their debts and trades and goods and services looked after without any interest, without any attachments. And that's what money creation was designed for, to do, was to help stimulate trade and to help balance trade amongst individuals. And we need to go back to that kind of state. And the Canadian Action Party voices for 50% of government-created money in order to look after ourselves socially and in order to look after our infrastructure projects within our country. Speculative banking, let it continue on the private banking world, let it continue with corporations, let it continue with companies. But for the best interest of all Canadians, we need to have our own source of money creation.
So, and Hellyer-Shaw also, he foresaw Canada losing its sovereignty, and he was a very prolific author, and he authored one book called Goodbye Canada. And I'd like to just quote a couple quotes from the book. Hellyer described globalization as, quote, the relentless drive on the part of the richest, most powerful people in the world to re-engineer the global economy for their own benefit. Further, he described this as involving the substitution of, quote, elite global governance as an alternative to the power of nation states. And we see that so much now, Christopher, in terms of that we're being regulated by entities and bodies and agreements that really originate, well, through the UN or international trade agreements and so on. And it's like we've surrendered more and more control over our own regulations and such within Canada through this process.
Exactly, and we've surrendered it to what benefit? That's what I like to remind people. You know, I made a dramatic change in my life and decided to leave a career I was at for over 20 years, 21 years to be actually correct. But I left it, and it is a hard economic state out there in Canada right now. It's very difficult to find any type of substantial work. It's nearly impossible for regular Canadians now to even consider leaving a parent home to look after their children. It's now Prime Minister Harper is talking about raising the pension age of where people would need to work a few extra years in order to qualify for social programs. What advantage joining this huge global platform has had for Canada? I don't see it. And if somebody could sit down and say, well, we're better off because of this, then sure, but we have more enemies now. Canada's now leading bombing runs in Libya. We have more political strife. We have more economic strife in this country than ever before. Where was the advantage of joining all these? And one of the things that a lot of people don't talk about anymore is the integrated border agreements that are being signed with the U.S. That started with the free trade agreements that Paul Hellyer first brought up and said, you know, these are bad for Canada. And we are now talking of having police being able to work on either side of the border. All your information is shared with the U.S. And anybody who's traveled enough through the United States, they have some great things. They have Disneyland. They have some nice things for the kids. But socially and economically, they just don't have an advantage for Canada. And I just don't understand why we're in such a quick rush to join them. And Canadians need to try to retain. Not to need to. We have to not try. We have to retain our individualism, and every country needs to retain its individualism for its own benefit.
And it seems also now, I think the understanding has come out that in ways this has been intentional to undermine the manufacturing sector of our own economy. Like, it seems Canada's wealth now is more from drawing on our resources, which have been processed and turned into products overseas. Like, we're resource-rich, and so we've been able
exactly.
to maintain a relatively good position. But there's less and fewer and fewer Canadian jobs. And in a way, I think the Club of Rome and other internationalist organizations have intentionally tried to undermine the American middle class. And the free trade agreements is partly how they've done this, to ship all these jobs over to China where they have slave labor, and then you don't have to pay auto workers $20 an hour. And in
exactly.
a way,
we've just accepted it. And I always use the example, you know, I'm from British Columbia. We have a huge raw log export. Trade now, huge, bigger than it's ever been. And here we are shipping raw logs to China and in return going to places like Walmart and Zellers and Costco's to buy a table made from that same wood that's probably not even going to last 5 or 6 years. And what happened to the day when we could take a tree and hand it to the local neighborhood carpenter who would build a masterful grand dining room set for a family that would last generations to generations. Now, that helps us locally. It keeps the money within our own system and has a true direct benefit to Canadians. And we're now talking about getting rid of all our, sending our oil overseas. You know, what would happen if we actually refined this oil here in Canada and gave our own citizens a lower cost gasoline source than the skyrocketing prices that we're facing now. And it's they've done it very well. The corporations, as any corporation does, believes that in order to maximize profit, it must eliminate expenses. Well, the biggest expense is labor, so we decided to eliminate that all across Canada. And then we decided to now start eliminating the social programs to support all those people that no longer are working. So the model doesn't work, and the only way that their model can actually succeed is through force. And that is my biggest fear for my children, is that we are heading towards a police state, and we are heading towards a forceful abiding of this is the situation, and you can't say anything about it. All the evidence is there. G20 was a prime example of it. Look, could anyone imagine our Canadian Mountie from going from a funny hat that we all adore and a nice bright red jacket and a proud horse.
And
we went from that to pure black Kevlar riot gear baton swinging force. That is as black and white as we need to see it, and we need to change it. We need to get back to the happy mountain. We need to get back to a open community.
Yeah, the G20 in Toronto, that was quite a disgraceful day in Canadian history. It was absolutely atrocious seeing the hordes of police attacking and assaulting people and arresting them in the parks and elsewhere, where people were only really out voicing their legitimate consent. And then it seems that we had these black bloc characters who I'm absolutely sure were agent provocateurs, who were set up to kind of stage vandalism to kind of then justify the role of the police in being brutal against people. And I think it was just another incident like in Montebello, Quebec, where there were protests against the SPP. And the only incident that occurred there was staged by the police. This is a terrible thing. I think Canadian people have been betrayed by our own police services, and I think it's even...
And we have to demand transparency and accountability by the police. What is wrong with the police wearing proper uniforms and being in a position of, hi, I'm here, and I was actually in the one of the first G8 meetings, or I think it was even might have been G6, was in Geneva, Italy, where huge amount of protests occurred over that global scene, and I was actually locked in within the core area of the meetings because my place of employment was right beside the hotel that President Bush at that time was staying at. So you couldn't even leave this area during this entire conference. Now, during that, you know, police shot a protester, there was fires, rioting, you know, it was a serious, serious deal. But they create this animosity by building up these fences, by coming in with riot gear, by coming up with tear gas. You know, it's like looking for a fight. And a friend of mine witnessed in Vancouver, in preparation for the Olympics and for preparation for some other events occurring there, police dressing up as homeless people, practicing their techniques on how they would grab somebody during crowd events. And it creates the, you know, I've worked wild animals my entire life, and as long as you confront something, you normally get a confrontation returned back to you. So, you know, Canadians in general just want to be heard. We want to have our voices said. So the police need to start analyzing what they're doing and start saying, you know what, we got to get away from being so paranoid that that everybody's out to get us that we have to swing first. That's an American mentality, is to attack first in the name of defend. Canadians always been a passive country, and rightly so. And till things show that, okay, maybe it's too dangerous, then it's now getting risky to demonstrate your democracy. That's the insanity of our conversation that we're having here. We're not talking about danger being directed towards the police because of a certain incident where they were idly standing by and someone did something. We're talking now it's dangerous to be voicing your democracy, and that's the insanity of Canada we live in right now, and we have to stop it. And we're not going to stop it by continuously allowing MPs and elected officials from making decisions without having the consultation of Canadians first.
I'm going to quote another quote here from Paul Hellyer, one of both of our heroes, and this again is from his book Goodbye Canada, and he actually has a chapter which is on what he called, the chapter's entitled The New World Disorder. And he opens with David Rockefeller's infamous statement to a Bilderberg group, where he thanks the corporate media for their participation essentially in deceiving the American public as to the goals and activities of the globalists. And Hellyer says about this, he says, Paul Hellyer says that David Rockefeller sums up what the New World Disorder is all about, the substitution of the elite rule for democracy. He further depicts the, quote, near universal acceptance of globalization as being inevitable and good for mankind as the, quote, worst case of brainwashing since the Third Reich in the 1930s. And I think we see that, Christopher, is like we no longer have an honest media that really informs the Canadian public about what's being done in terms of globalization and the surrender of Canadian sovereignty. So the people have been systematically and intentionally dummied down.
Exactly. And I've talked to a lot of reporters, and they tell me, you know what, reporting and journalism is almost a dying field now because you just read whatever's listed off the wire and you pass it on. You only have to grab a my children deliver the newspaper every morning, and so some days when it's cold and wet, I help them out, and you just have to glance on the front cover of the newspaper to see what stories have been circulated around the world. Then you turn on the radio, the same story's been heard. Then you turn on the TV, and the same story's been heard and shared. And we've gone to a system of one information source that is definitely regulated and definitely dictated by certain individuals, and that information is passed on to everybody else. And that information is usually designed to make you fearful of something, make you justify an increase in security at some certain level, whether that be internally here in Canada or externally outside of Canada. And the best thing society can do is simply turn itself off from the mainstream media and get back to having discussions like you and I are having, and having open and discussions. One thing I always am shocked at when I'm campaigning and discussing with people and talking about the party, and then they're saying, one of the biggest things we get is, oh, you guys are always talking conspiracy. I said, we're not talking conspiracy. We're asking questions here. We're asking questions. Who made the decision that we should have an integrated border with the states, and why wasn't I consulted? Now, why am I simply labeled as a troublemaker if I'm asking this question? Why? What happened where we couldn't find out these answers? And that's what Canadians are starting to awaken up to. They understand what we're talking about. They understand that 9/11 is a prime example. Organizations across the country would like to have an official answer from the Canadian government on why we sent troops over to Afghanistan and what evidence was there based on the 9/11. That's it, full stop. Tell us what information led you to send our troops over into Afghanistan. Show us the evidence and let us be the judge of it. And when we have lost our ability to question what's occurring, and if you question something, you are now labeled as a troublemaker, we are heading towards the Fourth Reich, and we are heading towards a completely different world than we have grown up with, and a completely non-existent Canada. And I'm frightful for my children. That's where we're heading, and that's why I'm involved, and I challenge everyone to get involved.
Yeah, it's certainly a very critical time, and these issues are coming to a head around the world in a way simultaneously. I mean, we see it all through the problems of the EU, and then the United American economy could easily collapse and face devaluation of their money, and it's kind of a global financial crisis, and it's all, in a way, created by the same people and same schemes.
And that's where you see this now, this new wave of rush of passing laws to control the internet, and to I'm not sure if too many people have read into the new privacy policies of Google. They've gone from a complete legal mandate to satisfy both you as the consumer and all the work that they're doing to protect you and your information, because they don't want to be held liable, to a complete turnaround to say, basically, we're going to be able to use your information any way we see fit if it meets the following requirements, if there's a suspicion of fraud or a suspicion of malice, a suspicion of something that we don't agree with. It's gone completely not worrying about you, but you have to accept all your information is going to be controlled. And, you know, I always say Google has a internal model that is don't do evil. And, well, it's gone to don't do evil because Google is going to get you. And that's and they're going to tell him. We've gone to such a monitoring state here, and monitoring to prevent. You know, that's it's up, open to interpretation, but monitor you so that your voice and your questions and your logic isn't shared anymore, because it might incite other people to start thinking about that. That's frightful. You know, we are all intelligent human beings. We all have the ability to work collectively together and share ideas and visions and come up with a plan that we can all work forward. And right now we see many, many world governments meet privately through these economic summits, meet privately through groups like the Bilderberg Group, and basically create new agendas for the entire population of the world without any involvement of the world citizens. And that's why you're seeing this unrest and discord, because people understand that. People get, hey, I didn't put you in that position to tell me what to do. I put you in that because you were, democracy said that you were going to represent me. And we're heading towards Roman times, where you know the Roman ruling elite decided to stop thinking about the citizens and started worrying about how they fit into the entire scheme, which is the nature of human beings. But there's also a collective soul of us and a collective group of us that say, you know what, the best interest of myself as an individual is what's the best interest for the group as a whole, and we're going to work for the betterment of the group as a whole, and that will prevail over the individualism of globalization. And that's where I still have confidence and faith that we can solve some problems by working together and showing that we aren't going to get fear. We are not going to get scared out of these discussions. We're not going to get quiet because of the oppression that's being placed on us. And many of us are willing to risk everything for the future of our children, and that's what it's going to take.
That reminds me of the expression, speak truth to power, which I think is very significant.
Yes.
I noticed, Christopher, we're coming up on the midway through our show, and we're going to just take a five-minute musical interlude. This piece, Christopher, is by a CAP member, Robin, a native Canadian, and it's called Sacred Land. And Robin, I've been using this as a bumper music for my show for a while. So maybe if it can get
the stereo. Great, I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Yeah, we'll wait here hopefully in a moment, and then we'll come back and we'll pick up on this discussion of the Canadian Action Party and what people can do to become involved and what's happening in the world situation.
Great, looking forward to it.
Okay, so we'll keep talking until we hear the music.
Okay. During this, I'm going to try to charge my phone while it's happening, so if you lose me, just give me a call back and I'll...
Okay.
I think it should be able to do both at once, but we're not sure.
Well, I'm going to just keep on going until we hear the music.
Certainly.
It's funny where you say people call you a conspiracy theorist, and you know I'm often say to people, yeah, I'm a conspiracy theorist. I'm not an idiot. It's like you would have to be an idiot, really, I think, to not realize that there are conspiracies. I mean, even these groups like the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderberg Group and the Trilateral Commission. I mean, Hellyer points out that each of these are secret society. They have oaths of secrecy. And the closer you are to the inner network, then the more the imposition of secrecy is required. And the word conspiracy really means to breathe or conspire together. And what it means is people, a conspiracy is when groups meet together to plot or plan activities which are illegal or undermining democratic and legal processes. And I think someone has to be an idiot to not think that conspiracies occur. In fact, they're occurring all the time because really it's these secretive groups that really fashion the destiny of humankind. So I gladly embrace being a conspiracy theorist, Christopher.
Well, it's you know, another definition of conspiracy, and it's just basically like you were saying, a group of people that get together to conspire together for a fixed agenda, you know, and that's, I think it's quite well how you put it. Yeah, so call me a conspiracist. I want to work together to retain Canada's sovereignty and stop anyone that's trying to dilute it. So if that's called a conspiracist, call a conspiracist. But, you know, a lot of these tactics are just designed to misdirect the people, and that's...
Exactly.
Once you get involved in the process, you start... laughing through it because you can see these deliberate attempts to misdirect the people, and it just takes you can't get sucked into it. You just have to say, okay, that's interesting, but remember my main question was this: who actually agreed for this integrated border? You know, I'm not talking about the conspiracy about the New World Order. I'm just talking about you signing an agreement with Obama about allowing our police to work back and forth together at one border. Now, that's all I'm talking about. You might be worried about the New World Order. I'm just interested that Canada now has an integrated border with the U.S. So, you know, that's what we just have to keep reminding people to do is keep the question simple, and once they go off topic, just bring them back to it. And once they try to, the conservatives are trained to do it. They're trained to. I actually was in an industry that was very oriented towards protecting itself for over 21 years, and I went through training sessions where they teach you how to misdirect information, and it's a, once you understand how it works, it's easy to bring it back. But I enjoyed you're right, maybe we should just admit, yes, I am. So now back to my question here. What's happening to Canada? It's a good point.
We haven't heard the music. I don't know if Doug's in the station there. Doug, do you want to put that piece on? And we'll keep talking away until we hear a play, but I'll just put the message out there to Doug in the studio if he's found that.
Yeah, and that's why I'm running in the Toronto Danforth by-election. You know, I do live out here in Vancouver Island, but we feel it's important for the party to have a voice in Toronto Danforth because it's such a powerful riding and such history in our country of G20 and other events that have occurred that show the need for a political party that will actually ask some tough questions.
Danforth, I gather that was the riding of Jack Layton, who died as a head of the NDP. That's
exactly.
In Toronto? Yeah, has that election been called for that riding yet?
No, it hasn't been called. It needs to be called by the end of near the end of February. So we're gearing up for it. We're putting plans in place and organizing volunteers and team members to be ready for it. And it's exciting because the last election snuck up on the party pretty fast, and the party was going through quite a few internal issues. And this election, we're ready. We have a strong national executive that's working very well together and working hard to bring the party to the forefront. And I've had experience with the last election, so I understand some of the trials and tribulations that our democracy places on small parties. And that was one of the reasons last year that I actually organized a another party discussion, and I flew to Toronto, and we had all the other parties from the mainstream all gathered together. And one of the first times that's occurred in this country for many, many years. And it was exciting to see everyone have a commonality that, we're not happy at the state of Canada, and we are willing to work together, so why aren't the other parties willing to work together for the best interest of Canadians? And it comes down to motive. It comes down to people who want a job. It reminds me of consultants looking for full-time work. If you're a good consultant, you don't need to be there that long, and if you're a good MP, you should be able to leave a system behind very quickly that allows it to be filled by anybody. And we have a lot of MPs that work very hard in order to get their three terms in order so that they can get a huge pension. And that's wrong, because we all know people that are suffering to even survive month to month. And if you're going to work for the best interest of our country, then make sure you're doing it for the best interest of the country. And and globalization is not in the best interest of our country. Sacrificing all our resources is not in the best interest of our country. Bombing Libya and Afghanistan is not in the best interest of our country. And until our members of parliament start acting on behalf of their constituents, and before they start acting on the best interest of Canadians, you can have the Canadian Action Party being there very loud and very vocal and very upfront to say that Canada needs to be saved, and we're going to do everything to do it.
That's how I see CAP. I see it as the one non-New World Order party. Like, all the other parties are part of the New World Order scheme or will not address the significant issues overtly. Like, they seem to create minor issues for elections to debate, but
exactly. No
one really addresses the most significant issues facing us.
I was shocked during the integrated border discussions, and got in touch with an elected NDP MP, and somebody had sent me their information on saying, you know, he's talking about that in the local paper. So I said, great. So I got in touch with them, and I said, hey, what are you guys doing to raise this up in Parliament? What's your party doing to raise this up in Parliament? Why don't we hear about this? Why is it this? And he goes, well, we're going to bring it up after the election. Like, after the election, this needs to be brought up during the election, because, you know, let's get the Canadian discussion happening here. And then we finished off the conversation with him asking if CAP would be, during the election, still be bringing up the sovereignty issues. And I'm like, yeah, of course we will, but I sure would hope that some elected MPs might be doing that for us.
It's unfortunate. I see our parties as really completely sold out. It reminds me of seeing a YouTube of a fellow confronting Jack Layton, where he was giving a talk in a cafe or signing a book or something, and the fellow asked him about 9/11. And Jack Layton, like he said, his response was, well, that's only a matter of historic interest. Like, how ridiculous. Because in my view, all the Canadian MPs know 9/11 had nothing to do with Muslims, and that the people who committed 9/11 actually owned the Canadian political parties. That's how I view the situation, and that's why none of can address the 9/11 issues.
You just reminded me of something that I often think once I got involved politically. You know, it's many times you can see politicians react and with their actions and with their words basically come out and say, well, that's too political to discuss. How can it be too political to discuss if your job is politics? You know, isn't that your role, is to deal with the tough political discussions? And you see leaders from all the major parties and MPs of these parties say, well, that's political. Yes, exactly. It is political, and that's the role of the member of parliament, is to be political. So start being political. You're getting paid a lot of money. You're getting pensions. You're getting benefits. You're getting travel allowances. Start being political and asking the tough question. And if it's too hard for you, and if it's too complicated or it's too political, then resign and let somebody out up there who can handle it, because you guys are making some, by avoiding these topics and by avoiding these discussions, we're not confronting what's happening at the corporate level and the corporate control of our governance, and that is that's the true shame for our children's future. Raw logs, our oil in our tar sands, our potash is in our prairies, has have to be worth significantly massive amounts of fortune for our future generations. And by privatizing and by getting rid of them without the future benefits coming to our children, it's wrong, it's stealing, and it's disgraceful.
And we see the same pattern elsewhere. Like, it breaks my heart. You see the World Bank move into all these third world countries and take their resources, and they prop up a puppet government that supports their looting of that country. And this has been repeated around the world. It's really all so tragic.
And you know what? It's at first I would always thought, well, maybe people are ignorant of it. And what I'm learning is, yes, there are some people that are ignorant that this actually occurs. But what more is shocking is the amount of people that say, yeah, it occurs, but what can I do about it? And why should I get involved? And you know, it's too hard for one individual to do anything. And that's the attitude that we have to change. You know, the last election, 39% of the populace that could vote didn't vote. That 39% is that didn't vote is a far greater majority than the majority government that we actually got. And that's the target that I feel CAP plays here, is that let's focus on the people that have given up on the system. Let's focus on the people that say, I just can't do anything. And as I remind people, until this country starts voting for things they believe in, nothing's going to change, because we've tried the other systems. And since 1974, we've had quite a few governments come and go of all different classifications, the NDP, the Liberals, the Conservatives, in any format that you want to, combination and alliances that they create. We've had that all. And we now pay in $170 million of interest in every day and sending all our natural resources completely bare without any manufacturing occurring in our country anymore. It didn't work, and I don't know how much longer we need to give them to keep trying to see what works, but this isn't working. Let's stop the bus here. Our generation needs to sacrifice for our children's future and say, enough is enough. We've made a mistake. What can we do to redirect this, and how can we change the focus from survival to our children's future sustainability?
I can understand, you know, the attitude, like, what can I do? Because I feel the same thing, even though I do what I can through my show and writing and what things I can do. I can understand that, because the enormity now of the crimes which have been committed by our governments. I mean, because, like, we know now 9/11 was a fraud. It had nothing to do with Muslims hijacking airplanes. And the reason the government isn't able to investigate 9/11 is because the people who committed 9/11 own our government. So it's like,
well, you know what people can do, and I was guilty of this for many years, is they can actually participate in the democracy process. Don't give up on it. You have to get back to participating in it. If CAP, you know, and we have a target for this by-election to raise more awareness in that. But say, even if Canadian Action Party during this by-election got 2 out of 100 people, or 2.1 out of 100 people, to actually vote and vote for the party, and that normally don't vote. 2 out of 100 people that normally don't vote, and just say, you know what, we're going to see what happens. That would send a shiver through the political system if the Canadian Action Party ever surpassed a threshold out of 2 out of 100. It would put a shiver down to say, whoa, people are getting involved now, and what more. And imagine what would happen during the by-election if 5 out of 100 people that normally just given up on the system have decided to vote again. That would send a shiver down to the country. And that's as small and significant that people have to realize. We don't have to win this thing to start putting doubt into the people that are controlling things. We just need to say something's happening. Things are getting organized. And, you know, and whenever you become a threat, yes, that's when the name-calling is going to come. That's when they're going to try to buy out politicians and buy out individuals. Well, I will never be bought and sold for my children's future. I am a alpha male that's going to protect his children forever, and until I pass from this earth, I will only pass from this earth knowing that I did the best for my children. And the best for my children is for them to have a direct involvement on the decisions that occur in their lives. And the voice that we have to do that is voting. We need to get out and vote. We need to vote for our children's future. And that's as simple as it is for me. So I ask anybody that's listening, that's in the Toronto area, please get in touch with the party. Please get in touch with our team and help us organize a simple message here just to get out and vote and voice your discontent by challenging the system. And challenge the system by voting when regularly you don't believe in it. And come and talk with us. Come and talk with the campaign manager. Come talk with myself and find out that we're just like other individuals. We're just decided to get more politically active and decided to get more involved and decided to lead parties and organize everybody. But at the heart of the matter, we're just like every other Canadian that's upset, and that's why we're doing this. So for me, this by-election is a chance to challenge Canadians to say, you know what, if we give up on it, we might as well all give up on it. But let's not give up on it. Let's do something. Let's really do something for our children this time. Let's simply show the authorities, let's show the current government that people are upset. And any sway and any recognition of a small increase to the Canadian Action Party, because the pillars are very clear, the pillars are very black and white of what we stand for, the message will be heard.
And you have a very wide program of policies. Like, I know the CAP has demanded an investigation of 9/11, and then another policy, CAP, has demanded investigation of the RCMP and CSIS and military intelligence for their role around 9/11. And you have policies calling for the banning of all chemtrails. CAP addresses all these policies that are, it's coming out in the truth movement. CAP has a policy, I think it's an interim policy now, to maintain internet freedom. You've got a wide variety of policies. And it's you're in an interesting situation because it's like the sheep people have four parties to vote for. Or I guess in Toronto area, three parties, excluding the Bloc, the Liberal, right, Conservative, and NDP, and the Green Party, four parties. So CAP is really the only party that will address the most profound issues. And it's like if the sheep vote can be split between those four parties, I think there is enough of a percentage of people who are waking up to the truth of what's happened, that I could see CAP, you know, tapping that percentage. And because of the number of other parties, you know, one never knows. CAP might begin to sneak a few people in there into the House of Commons. It would, or even begin to put the threat of such. But
exactly.
Even apart
and
from that,
this change will occur, and people will adapt to it. And, you know, our monetary reform policy regarding going back to the Bank of Canada, the Green Party actually has the identical policy in their books, but refuse to talk about it, refuse to bring it up, refuse to, many of their candidates don't even know it exists, The NDP has a similar policy that was passed in one of their conventions. They refuse to talk about it. They've refused to bring it up here. As long as we have politicians refusing to talk to about something, you have to be suspicious. If a politician is refusing to talk about something, and it's in that's wrong. And I'm shocked at sometimes where people say, "Oh, you guys have policies that address these issues." Well, yes, that's what a political party is about, is addressing these issues, and we want them addressed because you know what? As long as they remain unaddressed, they remain a thorn in our side. And once we can take all these thorns out, we can do more. We can focus on our child care systems. We can focus on our pension plans. We can focus on better communities and stronger communities. We can focus on infrastructure projects for manufacturing jobs for Canadians. We can do these. But as long as these thorns continuously just get debated and continuously get ignored, it saps our energy from actually doing some good within this country. And that's what it's designed to do. The entire system is designed to make it so complicated and so frustrating that people just give up and revert back to going to buy their $400 giant TV screen and seeing what's on the boob tube today. And that is what needs to stop. We have to get back to a society that says we have a great reputation around the world. We have a great peacekeeping force that will help other countries replicate this joy and beauty of our democracy. And we will once again be the Canada where people... I remember a time when I was traveling around the world, and I'm sure most people can. I remember when I would find Canadian flags on people's knapsacks, and I would say, "Oh, you're from Canada." And they say, no, actually we're not. But, it helps us when we're traveling because people think we're Canadians. Oh, okay. Well, guess
what?
Yeah,
I've heard that.
People aren't
yeah.
putting Canadian flags on their knapsacks anymore because it targets them just like anybody else of the world. We've misbranded ourselves and we've diminished it to nothing. It's now we're just like the rest of them, and that's wrong. It's wrong, and it's a shame, and we haven't lost it that much. We're definitely in debt to the private bankers, but you know what? The Bank of Canada can work that out. We can stimulate some growth in the economy in our own country. We can start investing in some mills again, and we can start investing in some oil refineries again. We can start investing into and let the world come shop here if they want, and if they don't like it, and everyone says, "Yeah, but they'll just come over and take us over." Well, you know what? I've been around and I've talked to other individuals and that, and they don't really seem to have an agenda to come take us over. They just would like open and free trade, not free trade where they're stealing things, but they just want to have an open system that we can actually go back to being civil, and that's what it's all about, not giving away everything, but let's just going back. The free trade in the definition of globalization is to give everything away free. The free trade that Cap likes to talk about is that it's open, honest, and transparent, and for the best interest of Canadians, and I think every Canadian can start seeing that we need to go back to that way, because it's the future's not very bright right now.
No, it's really dire, and I think it's horrifying that we've seen this. I forget the name of the bill, the Defense Authorization Bill in the States, which allows the government and military to pick up anyone, anywhere, anytime, murder them or torture them, without knowing the charges, without knowing the evidence against them, without being able to have a lawyer, without a due hearing. I mean, it's just complete criminal powers to a government.
Well, and look what's happening in Canada with the health bill. They keep changing the numbers, but basically it allows officials to come into Canadian homes without search warrants if they feel that a natural health product could be dangerous to the public. Well, definition of dangerous is depending on the person writing the piece of paper. And if the person that's dictating what is defined as dangerous is Monsanto, well, anything that's natural and good for you is going to be classified as dangerous. And if they don't have a seed patent on it, then they don't want you to be able to utilize it. And that's it. You know, we have allowing of American troops now to be able to come into Canada for any assistance for civil unrest, it's pretty black and white what they're working towards. And the Canadians have to say, you know what, we just don't want it. I watched some great interviews during the SPP, the Security and Prosperity Partnership talks before when they were talking about that, and some journalists around the world were saying, you know, yeah, well, I don't think it's going to be quite as smooth because, you know, the Canadians are upset about it. Well, they were right. We were upset about it, and we were able to delay some of the implications of it, and now they're implementing it a bit faster just because of the majority conservative government, but it's not a majority by the will of the people, and that's what keeps me continuing being involved and active. Is I don't believe we have the majority of Canada saying, yes, sell us out and let's join the global world. You know, I've talked to many immigrants that have come to this country, and they've come to this country for one reason. They've heard it's great. They love it. It's friendly. It's open. And it allows them great prosperity and a great future. Well, that's what we want to preserve for all of us, and that's what needs to happen. We don't want to turn Canada into like all the other countries around the world that are facing severe unrest, and unrest on a democracy level and unrest on a financial level. We don't want to join that platform right now, and never do. I don't believe, and as long as the majority of the population, I believes in that, we have hope in this country. There is hope because there is more loud people like ourselves. There is more people like yourself that are willing to talk about this in an open forum, to willing to talk about it. And alternative media is becoming to replacing mainstream media because people are getting tired of hearing the same doom and gloom and tired of listening to the senseless nonsense on the mainstream. So the alternative media is becoming. We are heading towards a renaissance of creativity and of open-mindedness and of discussion and wanting to work for the betterment of each other, and that is our hope, and we need to continue on it.
Well, it's certainly good that you're running in the Danforth area, and I mean, I think there is a growing number of Canadians who know something is wrong, even though most people can't really define what it is. I mean, even something as curious as the chemtrail spraying, you know, and which is really quite disgraceful that this goes on. And you know, any Canadian, you can go to your MPP or your MP and ask them about chemtrail spraying, and they'll all deny it occurs. And there's no accountability to the Canadian people. And this is a very serious. Do you get many chemtrails in your skies out in Vancouver Island?
Yeah, we have a lot of organizations that monitor it, and a lot up in Vancouver Island that monitor it and pass the information on to be heard, and they get ignored and they get and not heard, and that's where I get frustrated. Where is our government to at least alleviate the fears? If people within our government saying, well, they don't exist, okay, then prove to these groups that they don't exist and prove that it's not happening, and open yourself up and be transparent and open and say, no, this is what, see how it works. You know, this continuous deniability of our government on any topic that is slightly political is what's the most frustrating to me.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just say, it doesn't happen. Well, sorry, I don't trust you that it just doesn't happen. I don't trust that bombing children and families in Libya to a dictator that you already had done oil agreements with through, you know, Ronald Reagan, I don't agree that that's in the best interest of Canada, and I don't believe that's going to make me much safer here in Victoria. I believe I'm actually under more threat now because we've just now alienated ourselves with half a religious effect in our entire population here. So, you know, the deniability of government and the lack of willingness to have open and public investigations, that's all CAP is asking for. We're just saying, let's have open and public investigations that involve the citizens of the country as well. Why can't the citizens of this country be involved in the investigations on no matter what the topic is, whether it's fluoride in the water, whether it's police brutality in the G20, whether it's chemtrails, 9/11, or healthcare system, or jobs in the local community? Why can't citizens participate in this? And why are our politicians not being held accountable? And why are politicians not even addressing these issues and simply deferring to us and saying, you know what, I can't have time for this, get out of here? The role of an MP is to represent all the constituents within that riding, not just the ones that voted for you. And that's what's wrong with our political system. And that's why the Canadian Action Party is so adamant that any MP that gets elected from the Canadian Action Party first and foremost speaks on behalf of the entire constituency, not on behalf of the Canadian Action Party. The policies of the Canadian Action Party are very clear. Open, transparent governance, monetary reform for the best interests of Canadians, civil rights so that we actually retain them and ensure that they exist, don't exploit our environment for the sake of profit and greed. Let's start looking after the environment for our future children. You know, these are all the five pillars of the party are all pillars that people can agree with. And so the role of the MP for a Canadian Action Party is simply to represent and work and find the balance from all the constituents, from the business owner, from the corporation CEO, right down to the street sweeper. They all should be heard equally. They all should be represented equally. And that's what we don't have in Canada right now.
And part what you mentioned we don't have is we don't have transparency. And I think this is horrifying. It's like something like chemtrails. Now, the research is showing, I had Michael Murphy on my show about 2 months ago, who's investigated chemtrails and worked with J. Edgar Griffin in producing that movie, What in the World Are They Spraying? And his research shows that they've sprayed 10 to 20 million tons of all this aluminum and barium and strontium and heavy metals across North America. 20 million tons. And you have that, and then you have all the questions now emerging concerning the inoculation programs and how these are being mandated and financed by the government, and yet they're based on quack science. It's not adequately controlled research groups and so on. And it's like it's almost complete lawlessness, and there's no accountability. Like, the government's not accountable. We don't know how HAARP is being used. And it's like the people of Canada, you know, we're experimented on. Or these things are done to us, and we can't approach anyone. Everyone maintains plausible deniability. Or then they say, oh, you must be a conspiracy theorist if you see airplanes in the sky. Like,
well, and you know what? That's what I learned in the South Pacific. I lived and I brought in a big business idea into the country. And I went through working with the villagers. And I would have village discussions with 1,000 people. And
wow.
And people would come up to me from other countries and from America, and they say, oh, this just slows everything down and everything. I said, you know what, I've been here long enough. It actually doesn't slow things down. It actually makes everything work a lot smoother, because now everyone has equal say. They have equal opportunity to present their concerns, and now it obligates you to address all those concerns at once. So by doing that, you have an open and transparent forward progression now, because as you all agree, okay, we listen to everyone's concerns, we've addressed them, we've moved forward. If anything happens on the future, as it always does, and changes the plan or changes the idea, it stops. And now you have the entire group come back together and say, okay, no one's blaming each other because everyone agreed to move the cards forward at the same time. It's like I always remind people how consensus works. You know, you all get into a car and say, okay, where do you want to go? One guy might want to go to Toronto, another might want to go to California. Well, before the car moves, it's a good idea to decide where you're going. Right now, we have a government that's driving us to, we don't even know where they're going. It looks like they're going to around the world and we're going to fill it up with take all our resources and drop them off on the way. Well, many of us don't even want to get into the car if it's going that direction. So before the car even moves, we must agree where we're going. And that's what needs to happen in this country. And we need to be able to have. During the last election, I told the during the campaign, I said, you know what, $148,000 I think is a lot of money for this type of job because basically all you're doing is being a messenger on behalf of the constituents. So I would propose that you pay half. If I was elected, pay me. $75,000 is still a substantial amount of dollars. And you know what, with the rest of the money, let's use that to promote community-directive opportunities where everyone can share their ideas and talk about what's being discussed in Parliament. And I know exactly what you're doing. You know, whether that's spent on coffee and donuts so that we all meet, I don't mind, but that money should go back into the communities to have an easy forum to say, what's your views on this and how can we balance a consensus attitude on this?
Yeah, the idea of, like, community-based participatory democracy, I love that idea. Like, that's what I want in my world, you know. It's like where people work together for the benefit of all. And now our government has become a monster, really. It's serving these foreign interests and going along with the public deception of the Canadian people. I consider I'm an elder now because I'm over 60, and it's very disheartening to me. I had no idea this was happening in my country through most of my life, and now I wake up to it, and in a way, the new world order system is so in place, and it's frightening. It's frightening for our children. I like the native teaching that we have to preserve the planet for seven generations of our children, and I look at, my goodness, what have we left our children?
Exactly. And in the South Pacific has the same seven generation.
Do they?
I often pass that on to people, the importance of seven generations, and the importance of center, and people say, you have to understand, seven generations is possible. Is your great grandchild or your great grandparents and all, on the other side your great grandchildren? You know, that basically covers close to seven generations. It's not that far off, and that's what we need to keep reminding ourselves: is we need to preserve, remember what our great grandparents have done, and we need to understand what we're going to leave our great grandchildren. That's as simple as it is.
Yeah, I'm horrified a little bit. I grew up in a military family. My father was a Royal Canadian RCMP graduate and met my mother in England during the war period. And so I've always had respect for the military, and I now have two sons in the military. And I was supporting, you know, I was kind of in support of Canada's involvement in Afghanistan because I had believed the deception and the lies about that. And then when I woke up to that, I mean, to me, it's so disgraceful. And through history, Canada had that role, as you described, prided ourselves a bit on thinking we were peacekeepers. And I always liked that role. And I always thought the UN was a valuable institution. I now completely understand it differently, what's happened to the UN, which is tragic. But now Canada is becoming involved in these criminal wars. And it's like you were saying, our reputation is being destroyed. And you could see that when Canada didn't get that seat in one of the UN councils, because other countries see that Canada now has been corrupted. We're no longer upholding that traditional keeper role that Canadians aspired to.
Yeah, and all we have to do is change that attitude of we can't make a change to yes, we can make a change. It's that simple. You know, people have almost given up. It's like any long battle where you just finally say, you know what, I'm tired of fighting anymore, so I'm just going to give up. Well, I don't think we're that far away from shifting the tide here. You know, just like any big tempest storm comes into a harbor and in the middle while you're trying to lash the boats down and close your windows and secure the town, and everyone's thinking, wow, this will never end. Well, guess what? The storm always ends and the peace comes back. And that's where we're at right now. We're just at the tail end of it. We need to participate. Challenge everyone to get out during this by-election and then get your voice heard and come and find us. We'll definitely listen to you. We'll definitely show you our policies. We'll talk about what we believe. And more importantly, we're going to listen to what you believe. And we're going to listen to how you think things can get done. And we're going to share ideas and we're going to find other people and share their ideas and open it up. It's what's in the best interest. And the best way to find out if people are real or not is those that run away from public discussions. And that when people are not willing to discuss openly in a fashion, that means they're not being genuine and they have another agenda. And it's as simple as that. And the more that we challenge each other to stick together and to say, you know what, when we're having a discussion, let's make sure every point of view is heard. And that's where CAP comes in, is we believe our point of view is not getting heard at all. We can't even get answers on basic, serious questions here, and that's frightening.
Yeah. And so I guess CAP now, you have your new website. It's at actioncanada.ca.
Action Party.
Action Party. Yeah, so it's not CAP. It's just actionparty.ca.
Yeah, I believe both sites are still working. The CanadianActionParty.ca and ActionParty.ca both work. It's to remind people that it's time for action. We're about action. We're not about lobbying. We're not about talking. We're about doing something, and we're going to do it through the political arena. And those that have given up on the political system understand that there's people within the political system that refuse to give up and share your same concerns, and we refuse to. Once you leave the playing field, it's automatic default, and they count you a loss no matter what, and we're not going to let the other side win without having some representation of those that demand for the truth.
Well, when I participated in CAP, I liked it because we got to speak the truth or ask the questions, whereas I wondered, boy, what's it like for those people in the other political parties when they know it's all based on lies? Like, it really must be horrible for them, really, to know kind of what's going on and yet to maintain that public deception. I'm sorry for them often, like... I guess I've always hoped that people within the military and within the police and within politics, that they would turn themselves. Like, we need a renewal movement within the Conservative Party itself and within the Liberal Party and within the NDP Party. Like, all of these parties have some honorable tradition. And in a way, their parties have been hijacked. And it's I guess I'm affected by the tragedy of it all. I is so beyond anything I could have imagined.
It is tragic, and it's tragic what's happened to our country. And I still have faith that there's many people out there that are willing to not give up on it and to make a stand on it. And as I said, in the Toronto Danforth riding, if 5 out of 100 people that normally don't participate and say, send a message, a clear message that we can make a difference, and there is many of us here. You know, the Occupy movement always mentions the 1%. Well, that means 2% could beat them. So let's start moving up the percentages here and challenging the system, and others will keep on talking about it. You know, in the during the Occupy movement here in Victoria, when it first started, I was invited to speak, and I spoke there with my son because I think it's important of the message on monetary reform. And as my son even spoke, and he mentioned, you know, you're, yes, please occupy because you're occupying for my future, and make sure that I'm able to occupy my future and the ability that I want to do it. And there was two NDP elected MPs there that were very shy and said, yeah, we're here, but please don't bring too much attention to us. But you know, I ended up thanking them from coming anyhow, just because I think it's important people realize, you know, it must be hard to be an MP that sees all this stuff happening to our country and still have to listen to what your boss tells you because you're worried about your job. It's time to get some politicians that aren't there for work. They're actually there for the interest of Canadians and in the interest for their children.
It's ironic because I was up on Parliament Hill a couple months ago when there was an Ottawa 9/11 group had a day's activity on the Parliament Hill, and I spent the day on Parliament Hill, and it was a beautiful, clear day, but they were chemtrail spraying all through the day, and I got very dramatic shots of all the chemtrail spraying over Ottawa, and I was thinking, and they're spraying you guys too, like talking to our government. Like they're being sprayed too, you know. And I live out by where there's a major RCMP base, and you guys are being sprayed too. Don't you get it? You got to wake up, guys.
Yeah, we need to challenge people to ask questions and seek the answers. And that's what keeps me going, because I can see the hiding away from it. I can see the running away from it, and I can see the, oh, what should I say, faces approach people. And, you know, politics shouldn't be about winning. It should just be about creating the best system of democracy. And the best system of democracy demands the participation of the citizenry. That's what democracy is about. And as long as we are not allowed to speak our mind, and as long as we have to worry about the fear of police-instigated violence in events like the G20, we need to question what's happening, and we need to demand a democracy that says, yes, I'm active in my democracy, and I'm allowed to speak my mind, and I'm allowed to ask you these tough questions, and I want representatives in the House of Commons that will do the same. And we've got to stop sending people up there that just follow orders, and we've got to stop sending people up there that are happy because they were invited to a certain committee. Okay, you know, we can committee and we can talk and we can do everything. What's the clear action steps that's going to preserve Canadians' individualism? What's going to help return our reputation to being the world's best friend? And that's what I'm interested at right now, and that's why I'm involved, and looking forward to running in Toronto.
And there's a valuable role. I would encourage Canadians, look at the CAP site and become involved. And one of their activities is they're trying to form EDAs, electoral district associations, for each electoral district in Canada. And it's a small group of people who kind of get together to support a candidate and to educate other citizens. What we need is a community grassroots-based effort here where we form such EDAs around the country, and they start putting on truther-type events, talking to people about what's happening in the community and these very important issues. We need that type of community-based grassroots activism. And I encourage listeners, if you're in Canada, join up with CAP and support such a program and start meeting and talking to other people in your district who share similar concerns. And I think it's a very valuable model for grassroots activism that CAP has trying to get these EDAs up and running.
Yeah, the EDAs are so important, and part of the huge part of the strategic plan that I drafted when I took over as leader, because till the communities get involved in all their politics at every level, and that's mm-hmm. federally, nationally, and municipalities, until they get involved at all levels, no change will occur. But as long as we can form nucleuses of concerned citizens that bring up these issues all the time, at all situations, you will start seeing them being heard at higher and higher levels within our system. And the electoral district associations are so important. The party has a policy that 80% of all the money stays within the electoral district association. Some money goes to the national office in order to help form other electoral district associations. And within the electoral district association, the EDA, the members themselves decide who's going to be their candidate, decide what issues are important for their communities. Till we have governance like that, we're going to continuously get lobbied by corporations and external pressures from the world banking elites that exploit our country. And the citizenry needs to get organized at a grassroots level and can do so. And politics should very much be a grassroots level. And that's I'm excited about the EDA plan. And that's another reason I'm running at the Toronto Danforth election, is to leave behind a strong EDA and to work with the local members there and to the new volunteers and the new people that just get awoken to our party and say, yes, here, this is it, this is yours, this is your power, this is your association, and I'm helped stimulate it and help start it, but at the end of it, it's going to be yours, so make sure you leave behind something that can work towards the future.
Well, CAP would certainly be a breath of fresh air to emerge in the Canadian political scene, and I really wish you the best. And I want to mention one other thing. You have a convention coming up in Ottawa in August of this year. Perhaps you might just share around that, Christopher.
Yes, the convention for the party is planned for the week of August 15th in Ottawa, because that's the birth date of the nationalized Bank of Canada. August 15th, 1938, the Bank of Canada was nationalized. And so we're going to have our convention around that date, and it's going to allow us to bring to Ottawa other monetary reformists and people that are concerned about our lack of use of the Bank of Canada, and that's why we're excited right now. You know, the Committee on Monetary Economic Reform, based out of Toronto, just filed an action suit against the federal government for not using the Bank of Canada, and it's now going to go through the federal court process to challenge why they're not using it. It's an amazing time for monetary reform. The Occupy movement brings up monetary reform. CAP's been talking about monetary reform since its formation in 1997, and the convention's going to be a perfect time to talk, and we're going to have a big birthday cake for the Bank of Canada and remind Canadians that we still own a bank, and that's the beauty of our policy, is that this is only a political decision to use it. All the legislation still exists. The Bank of Canada Act still exists. It's just the political will to use the Bank of Canada again. That's all it requires. And we're fortunate in Canada, and we just have to remind Canadians that we own a bank, and doesn't it make more sense to use it?
And that's just one pillar of the Canadian Action Party. My experience with your party was very positive, and I know I took some policies to the convention which were passed at the convention unanimously, and it was like, sometimes it's so empowering to be with other people and actually do something. It's like people fall into an apathy and fearfulness. But when you actually get out there and, you know, attend a Occupy Wall Street event or attend something, it's really empowering. And that's what we need. We need the community, ordinary citizens, to be empowered again to help take back our country. And I think Christopher Porter and the Canadian Action Party are important pieces in that puzzle in Canada. And I'd like to thank you, Christopher. We did a long interview. Thanks for sticking the whole way through it. And it was a pleasure having you on. And if there's any time that you have any events coming up or you'd like to come out or discuss any events, just let me know, and I'd be pleased to have you back on in the future.
I appreciate it, Christopher. I appreciate you sharing your experiences with CAP, and I think it's so important. I think you summarized the party up well. It's a party that's open and transparent and wants all its members to be active and have a voice heard, because once you prepare a system and a platform that allows everyone to be heard, you get the better answers, you get the better solutions, and you get a better community, and together we can build a better Canada. And I thank you for having me on your show, and would love to join you as we get closer to the election again.
Great. Thank you. I'll let you go, Christopher,
thank you, Christopher.
And I'll just take a minute, close down the show. So that was Christopher Porter, the Canadian Action Party. And you can see their website, actionparty.ca. And Christopher was very well spoken today. And well, that brings us down to the close of today's show. My website is at zeropoint.ca, and I would like to promote my new book, 1137, which talks about what's happening in the world today, the world situation, 9/11 research, chemtrails, subjects along that line, which is out of my usual area of expertise on mystical science, but since waking up to what's going on in the world, I've put some of my other work on the side to try to help to address this crisis occurring on the planet. Okay, so I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. I'd like to thank Doug at BBS Radio. And until the next show, this is Christopher Holmes. Please remember yourself. Try to awaken in the human heart, because I think it's those of us who come together and are upright of heart that we need to take back this planet. Okay, thank you all. Goodbye.